Monster Man, Episode 220, Margoyle and Marid. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through the M chapter of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. Like the earlier episodes this week, there are no updates because this episode is being recorded well in advance, but next week we should be back to a regular news schedule. Alright, first up we got the Margoyle. Now, a Margoyle is a little bit like a gargoyle, but more so? In a few recent episodes, I've criticized Jim Holloway's illustrations, so I want to say here that the Margoyle illustration is really good. It plays to the strength, the slightly cartoonish nature of being like this grotesque creature that really suits Holloway, and he has a good expression on the Margoyle's face. Way back in Season 1, we covered the Gargoyle, and I said that one of the things that I was most disappointed about is that the Gargoyle, like when you think of a Gargoyle, you think of gargoyles on medieval or medieval-inspired buildings. That is to say, you think of these, well, many of which are not, in fact, gargoyles. They're actually grotesques, but I think only architectural history students care about that difference. You think of stone creatures, but there's nothing particularly stony about the gargoyle, right? Like, a gargoyle is a stone carving that looks like a little devil, but the gargoyle in D&D is just a little devil. It turns out that what you think of when you think of a gargoyle in D&D is actually a margoyle. So the stony looking ones, those are margoyles rather than gargoyles. And, you know, obviously they're a bit tougher than their bog standard gargoyle counterparts. But I really like the margoyle because this is what I wanted out of the gargoyle. And because it's got a stony appearance, it's really good at blending in caves and castles and what have you, right? So it's got sort of camouflage that, I guess, blends in against stone backgrounds. But you can also imagine a situation in which you just thought it was a gargoyle in the sense of an architectural gargoyle. Obviously, you would have to run several scenarios in which there were architectural gargoyles before the gargoyles started coming to life and attacking people, because if I'm playing Dungeons & Dragons and someone drops in a description of somewhere as having gargoyles, you best believe I am keeping a careful eye on them. I was not born yesterday. I know that if someone mentions the gargoyles, they are coming to life. When someone says, "This room is full of statues," I immediately go, "Oh, is it?" There's a fun detail here, which is that, you know, margoyles have hard, rocky skin, so they're hard to damage with normal weapons. They can only be affected by magical weapons of plus one or better. And so therefore, they collect them, because if they're in the Margoyle's collection of magical weapons, they can't be used against it, right? Like, it tries to get its hands on all the magical weapons that it can find precisely because it's vulnerable to them. Which on the one hand is, that's actually pretty sound, right? Presupposing that you can't just destroy a magical weapon because it's magic, then the Margoyle's behavior actually makes sense, although if I was the Margoyle, I would find myself a body of water or something like that and just drop those bad boys right in. I guess it lives in a cave, so they're buried underground kind of by definition. But it also means that if you're fighting a Margoyle and you find that your common or garden steel weapon is not doing the trick, well, you got a solution in place. You don't have to worry about it. And again, I think that's pretty great. So I'm pretty pleased with the Margoyle, and the only note of criticism that I have to offer is that this is sort of what I wish that the Gargoyle had been like. But I guess now we have both. More is pretty much always better when it comes to monsters, at least up until the point where it gets confusing, which I guess this could be, right? Someone goes, "Oh, it's a sort of gargoyle," and you go, "Huh, I think actually you'll find that's a Margoyle." And then they mock you, and you deserve it. Next up, we have the Marid. Now, this is another type of genie. And I mentioned the term back when I did my special episode on Jin. And I said that there are various terms that are used to describe the Jin. You got Jin and Jan and Marids and Ifrits. And that those terms are not really used consistently. So you will find in a passage in the Arabian Nights that a creature is sometimes called a Jinn and sometimes called a Marid, right? They're all more or less synonymous, And when writers try to divide them up into discrete categories, they are not always the same category. So we have almost a D&Dism, right? This attempt to impose clearly separate boundaries on things that are, you know, more blurry in the folklore or literature that they come from. That's fine. In Dungeons & Dragons, we have, for the sake of convenience, to break things down into smaller parts, and that means having the Jann be different from the Marids, be different from Ifrits, be different from Jinn, be whatever. I guess the Dao is the other one. I don't really know anything about those guys. So the Marid here is given a very kind of conventionally Arabian Nightsy image. Once again, Holloway doing nice work. And I really like them. I think these are the watery ones. The Jann were a mixture of different elements. The Marids are water, and I wonder if that's just because Mar means sea. I mean, I don't think that's where their name comes from, although I don't know off the top of my head. And they are significantly more powerful than the Jann, right? The Jann were quite human scale by contrast. The Marids are definitely powerful supernatural beings, and they are ruled over by a padishah. And it says that they all have these kind of noble titles, which is something that I really like. There's no such thing as an ordinary Marid. And it says that they all think that they're Atabeys or Baylor Beys and so on. There's a blend of Turkish and Persian terms there. So Atabey and Baylor Bey are Turkish terms, but Padishah is a Persian word. You'd think that the head Marid would be the Shahanshah, but Padishah sounds pretty good. It's a good word, Padishah. I'm always a little cautious of Jinn, because when representing things that are clearly inspired by Middle Eastern cultures, I don't want to descend into kind of Arabian Nights Orientalism. But on the other hand, these are monsters from the actual Arabian Nights. Like, it's kind of in there. And I struggle against my own impulse, which is that all that Arabian Nights stuff is super cool. Hopefully, because I've spent some time studying the history of the medieval Middle East, I could present a more varied and nuanced portrayal of those cultures or of something inspired by those cultures. But I definitely still have the temptation to have, you know, some guy tell you that he's the only honest camel dealer in Cairo. And I don't know about that necessarily. I'd want to do a better job than that. But the Marid is cool, and it works well because, again, we have these cultural assumptions about Jinn. You know, when you see the Marid appear, you're thinking, ooh, this guy's probably trouble. He's probably got all kinds of supernatural powers, and I'd better handle him with caution, which I think is the right attitude. So I feel like the Marid effectively achieves what it sets out to achieve, even if it does that by, you know, relying on a genre of art that, you know, maybe today we have some reservations about. One thing that I am not super thrilled about the Marid is just its entry. So all the information that you need about the Marid is there, but presented in kind of a confusing, or not confusing, but in a way that's not very efficient. You know, you say what you like about these 70s and 80s D&D hardbacks, and what I like to say about them is that I like them a lot. But you can't say that they're very well organized. Though, I mean, in their defense, there are aspects of their organization that I've had reason to praise before, such as having a lot of the rules that you need in one place in the entry instead of relying on you to remember a bunch of generic rules. It makes them really easy to pick up and use in something else, which is how I mostly use them, so maybe that's why I like it. But, like, there's a sentence in here where it says, "They have both ultra-visual and infra-visual capabilities," just at the end of a paragraph that is not about that. So as someone who has cause to teach writing, you know, like essay writing and other kinds of informative or persuasive writing, I definitely feel like I could make some of these books a good deal shorter. And sometimes you feel that there is something to be said for the organization of a modern monster manual. Now, maybe you lose some of the charm, but when you open, you know, a 5th edition monster manual, the entry is much longer, yes, probably, right? I mean, the monster probably takes up an entire page of a big hardback, much of which would be a big color illustration. But when I am looking for a particular piece of information about a monster, when I want to know what kind of vision it has, what kind of languages it speaks, what kind of, well, languages are all in the same place in these books, but, you know, all of that information is always in the same place. And that's true for some things in the Monster Manual and Monster Manual 2, but it's not true for others. And I feel like, you know, they developed a format, they started out with it, and then they started to realize, like, ah, we should probably have put, say, you know, what kind of vision does it have? Does it have ultra vision? Does it have infravision? We should probably have put that in the stat block, but we didn't, and we can't go back and change it. So here it is. attached to nothing that has anything to do with it. It's fine, and it means that these books reward reading them differently than the way that you might read a monster manual from the current editions of most big-budget role-playing games, and there are good things about that. But at the same time, sometimes I encounter a sentence like that one, and my red pen starts twitching. But that's a minor point about what otherwise is quite a fun monster, and again, a bit like the Mantis Comet Giant from earlier this week, is fun really because we already have feelings about the thing that it's derived from. Alright, that is all the monsters that we have time for today, so please join me next time as we continue our journey through Monster Manual 2 on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.